major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The news that the Times-Picayune, New Orleans' daily newspaper, was reducing delivery to 3 days weekly and laying off hundreds of employees sent shockwaves around the country. Award-winning food writer and restaurant critic Brett Anderson joins us with his personal story and plans for the future. Then, Yakaman lady Linda Green gives us the lowdown on her recent experience on the Food Network's Chopped. Roving reporter Frank McMahons reveals where to find the most obscure Hispanic ingredients without leaving Baton Rouge. And you'll meet this week's culinary heritage hero, a farmer from Southwest Louisiana. All that and more coming up on this week's Louisiana Eats. Food writer and restaurant critic Brett Anderson has been an integral part of the New Orleans food scene since he began at the Times-Picayune in the year 2000. His writing has appeared in Gourmet, The Washington Post, Food & Wine, and Salon. He's won 14 awards from the Association of Food Journalists and 2 James Beard Foundation Journalism Awards. Most recently, Brett received a prestigious fellowship from the Nieman Foundation for Journalism based on his work at the Times-Picayune and was simultaneously laid off during the newspaper's recent reorganization. Brett, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, let's talk about your initial involvement with food and the newspaper.
With food and the Times-Picayune newspaper, or food and newspapering?
Well, you know, let's talk about where you came from.
Well, I'm from Minnesota originally. Was born and raised in the Twin Cities area, and I got my first job at a newspaper when I was still in college at a weekly newspaper in Minneapolis, where I was a rock music writer. Which, at that point in my life, was basically my life's ambition. I wanted to write about rock music, and I did that for several years, and the editor who hired me there brought me with him to Washington, D.C. when he left to edit a newspaper out there. And it was that particular editor who had the idea that I should start writing about food. And so when I moved to Washington, D.C., I became a staff writer at this newspaper where I wrote feature stories and a lot about music as well. But I also wrote a weekly column called Young and Hungry. And that was my first, you know, introduction to food. I did not get that job based on a resume. You know, I was I had never written a word about food in my life before I started writing that column. But I guess a critical voice that this particular editor thought would serve food and restaurants well, and sort of a natural curiosity, and probably most of all a voracious appetite. I was pretty young at the time and known to kind of be able to put it away. But I did that job for 5 years, and as it went along, the food part of it kind of gradually became more of my professional identity than I would have guessed it would have been. And, you know, when I started out writing that particular column, my ambition really wasn't to end up writing about food full time. It was more to be like, you know, a magazine writer or sort of a general news assignment reporter. But as time went on, I just found that particular beat felt to me pretty bottomless in terms of the stories it provided. And I think actually having come to it from the perspective of someone who was very much a neophyte and who came from the Midwest and not a very food crazed background really served me well in some ways because I had so much to learn. I still feel like I've hardly even scratched the surface. And as a journalist and just a natural curious person, that's a really exciting position to be in.
So you came here from Washington, D.C.?
I came here from Washington, D.C. In 2000, at the end of 2000. My column started running in the Picayune in early 2001.
Well, that was really a bit of a coup in and of itself, because you were still a pretty very young journalist. I mean, you're not an old man today, Brett. So,
I mean, it was a coup for me, no doubt. And it's still sort of a mystery to me as to exactly how I got the job. But, you know, at that time, you have to remember the newspaper industry itself was much larger, and there was a lot more jobs out there for food writers. And, you know, attracting someone to New Orleans with a lot of experience, I think, would have been difficult at that time. As wonderful as New Orleans is as a food town, you know, I can understand why they were maybe looking for someone who was younger, who they thought might stick around. And I think that might have been the main thing. You know, I'm a big music fan, and I love urban areas, and a lot of the things that might turn some people off about New Orleans who weren't born here and weren't already in love with it weren't the types of things that were going to turn me off. And I think Jim Amos sort of knew that.
Well, what's it like to be a restaurant critic in such a food-centric city as New Orleans?
Well, it's a pleasure. You know, when people sort of outside the city ask me questions like that, I think the assumption that the greatest part of my job is the fact that I just get to eat out for free, you know, is I think a fairly widely held assumption. And I think that that is, it's an understandable one, but it's not really true. You know, the best thing about my job is that I get to write about a topic that this city that people are so sort of fascinated by is so closely identified with. You know, food is really something that defines New Orleans, and there's an audience that really loves food and really appears to like reading about food and reading about New Orleans. And to me, that's the best part of my particular job. It's you get to write for an audience who really believes that there's sort of something at stake when you're writing about restaurants and food.
Well, that's an interesting point, because, you know, New Orleans is often criticized for staying the same. You know, our food has stayed the same basically for centuries. And I think we're coming from that same sort of conversation, because everybody here feels like it's their personal steak. Mm-hmm. Now, why do you think that it's like that here?
Why does it stay the same?
Yeah, why is it like this here?
You know, I think that's probably above my pay grade. I once had to give a talk at a conference to the Southern Foodways Alliance, and the topic was what sort of New Orleans music taught me about New Orleans food. In sort of preparing that talk, I forced myself to think about how much being a very kind of serious and avid music lover has helped me as an outsider more quickly learn New Orleans culture, and I think helped me understand its food in a weird way. And the gist of it is, I think that, you know, there is this culture of, in the music community and in food, where there's a respect for the canon, that, you know, when you learn the standards, there's an art to that. And that's a way to, you can express your own artistic voice and your own personality by interpreting work that has been handed down over generations in your own way. And I really see the New Orleans food, particularly the classic recipes that you see sort of everywhere, through that lens. It took me a long time to get that, but I think that there's a strong tradition here of upholding tradition, and I think it's a beautiful thing. And I also think that it can be overstated how much food doesn't change here. I mean, I've been here 11 and a half years now. Particularly in the last five, I think you've seen in the restaurants in New Orleans a lot of creativity that still pays its a certain respect to the tradition that I find pretty exciting.
Like what? Give me some examples of that. What are you talking about?
One of the more sort of obvious examples, but I think it's obvious because it's good, is what Donald Link and Steven Strzajewski have been up to at Koshan, where they've taken Cajun cuisine and, you know, they sort of cleaned it up without fancying it up. And all of a sudden, this place that is sort of synonymous with South Louisiana cuisine, New Orleans, you go in there and you realize that we haven't even scratched the surface on this food. And, you know, they bring modern techniques to the table there, so to speak, but not in a way that I think is terribly corrupting. And it's one of the better examples, I think, of showing how you can create a modern restaurant that satisfies everything that a serious diner wants from a modern American restaurant while still working completely within a tradition.
Well, Brett, I'm really curious to hear from you personally how important you think anonymity is in the job.
Well, I wish I had it. You know, the argument for anonymity is with restaurant critics is, you know, basically that if you go to a restaurant and you're not known as a critic, that you're going to be treated like a regular customer. And I think that that's true. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to want to safeguard. And in the early years that I lived here, I did what I could to safeguard that. I always got reservations in other people's names. I had credit cards with other people's names on, you know, fake names on them. And I frankly still do that. Over time, New Orleans is a pretty small town. And I'm, you know, a tall white guy with glasses and a funny laugh. And I eat out 10 times a week. Over time, people figure out who I am. And it's not because I've introduced myself. I broke that rule a little bit after Hurricane Katrina, but that was for journalistic purposes. I wasn't trying to curry favor. So even when I go to restaurants that I know are going to know who I am the minute I walk in, I do not give them a heads up. I always get reservations in other people's names and all that sort of thing. But I do not think anonymity is so important that I'm going to put myself in disguise every day. That becomes something that, well, frankly, I would spend all day in makeup. You know, I mean, it's just not reasonable.
That would be bad.
And I don't want to be the guy, you know, if it doesn't work, then I'm sitting there at the table all night with the guy in the clown nose, you know, and it's not worth it enough for me. But in general, when I say that I wish I still had anonymity, I do like the idea of being able to go to a restaurant and not cause people to become nervous or, you know, or feel like I'm working, you know. And so that's more of a personal thing. But, you know, the short answer to your question is I think that it's important, but I don't think losing your anonymity means you no longer have the ability to do your job adequately.
What's your favorite memory looking back over the last almost 12 years?
My favorite dining memory?
I guess we're talking, this is a food show, Brett.
Well put. Probably I've been eating out 10, sometimes 12 times a week for 11 and a half years to think of like one memory.
Well, I'm not asking you here to like pinpoint, and this is where I had the finest meal. Food memory is such an evocative thing. It's not necessarily just about the meal.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back over your 12 years, almost 12, what's sticking with you? What's stuck to your ribs?
I guess having acquired like an accumulation of taste memories that makes me feel like when I taste something, it tastes like a place is really valuable to me. And I know that's not really a memory, but it's like a collection of memories that I get, that I understand as something that is a single entity in a sense. If I was to leave, you know, to move away from New Orleans and come back for a weekend, you know, I've got a list of restaurants that I would want to go to, and they tend to be the old-fashioned ones that you can't find anything like them other places. And so, you know, maybe that's because those places have the memories of eating at places like Galatoire's, like Brightson's, like Clancy's and Upper Line, or, you know, the roast beef po' boys at R&O's. Because I've become so aware that the experiences that those restaurants give are so singular to New Orleans itself. And I mean, there's a lot of restaurants in New Orleans that do that. But, you know, those places are the ones that leap to mind immediately. Those are the places I really would want to continue to create memories at.
We've been talking with restaurant critic and food writer Brett Anderson about his life in New Orleans. After the break, We continue our conversation with Brett and hear his thoughts on what's going on at the Times-Picayune. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. On today's show, Times-Picayune food writer Brett Anderson spills the beans on what's happening with New Orleans Daily Paper. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with award-winning food journalist Brett Anderson continues with the story of how he learned the news.
Well, you know, there was rumors about it going around for a couple of weeks. I'm sure for longer than that, but I probably didn't catch wind of it, you know, until a couple of weeks before it was announced in the New York Times. I happened to be in New York at the time that that happened, so I was on vacation for a week.
That was exciting, huh? Great way to take a vacation.
You know, it's been a difficult time. I you know, the Times-Picayune has meant a lot to me personally and professionally, and it's obviously meant a lot to a lot of people in this community. And it's hard to see an institution like that change so drastically and so quickly. But I'm rooting for it. I still have a lot of colleagues I respect a great deal who are working there going forward. I'm rooting for my colleagues who aren't. But whatever happens, I do think that there are people in place who do incredible work, who I think and hope are going to be in the position to continue doing that really valuable work. And as painful as this last couple of months have been, I'm still trying to be as optimistic about the future of that organization as I can be.
Brett, the single thing that I think everybody wants to hear is an explanation from you about how there could have been a misunderstanding that you were being fired, or that you weren't fired, or what's that all about?
I don't want to belabor this point. And the main reason is because, you know, I wasn't the only person laid off that day, and I don't think that my being laid off should be thought of as being any more disappointing or tragic than anyone else's. And the fact of the matter is that I was offered an opportunity to come back. And so I just don't feel right picking at that wound. But I will say that, you know, the people that work at the Picayune who have been charged with making these changes have been given an overwhelming amount of responsibilities. And in the process, there are going to be mistakes made. There's going to be miscommunications. And I don't, frankly, entirely know what happened with me. But, you know, one explanation I was given is that if they would have not severed me, they would have had to fire someone else. Mm. And in as much as that is the case, I think it was the right thing to do.
Well, another sort of twisted tie-in to this is that you were also at one time a contributor to every food fanatic's favorite magazine, Gourmet. And Gourmet is another print publication that unfortunately died a pretty sad death because of Newhouse decisions, right?
Well, it's true that Gourmet is no longer, and it's true that it was ultimately owned by the same people as the Times-Picayune. I'm no expert, but it's obvious that, you know, the daily newspaper model, the business model that has been extremely successful for newspaper owners for generations, basically doesn't exist anymore in the way that it did. And, You know, while what's happening at the Picayune I find to be upsetting, I also am a realist, and I get that sort of something needs to be done in order to preserve, you know, daily journalism as we've sort of come to know it in major media markets across the country. And no one, as far as I can tell, has come up with a great model yet. And so, you know, what they're doing at the Picayune is what our ownership has decided to try. And agree with it or not, I think we can all agree that something had to be done. You know, whether or not this was the right thing is, you know, history will be the judge of that.
Brett, let's talk about the new exciting things that are coming on your horizon. Could you explain to us what is a Nieman Fellowship?
A Nieman Fellowship is it's something that's been around for 75 years. I believe I'm part of the 75th class. You know, it's a foundation based out of Harvard University that invites 12 journalists from across the country and then 12 other journalists, international journalists, to be part of a Nieman class every year. And the opportunity that you're afforded as a Nieman Fellow is that they pay you to basically avail yourself of all of the opportunities that Harvard has to offer. You can take any class that you would like. You have access to all the professors to pursue independent studies. And then the foundation itself has quite a bit of programming that you're a part of as well, that a lot, I think, is related to building your skills as a journalist and that kind of thing. And it's also the spirit of it is to provide mid-career journalists who have been on deadlines for a good long time to step back for a while and get off deadline and to and sort of engage their mind in different ways. So I'm really looking forward to it.
What are you most looking forward to about this upcoming experience? So what's the shiniest thing in front of you?
Well, I have to say that I still don't entirely know what to expect. There's 2 weeks of orientation that I begin in the middle of August that, you know, is designed to really introduce Nieman Fellows to what they can expect and to what is the true depth of the offerings that Harvard has. I do have some topics that I'm interested in exploring. You know, one is to sort of study and research the people and forces that gave rise to modern celebrity chef culture, which I know in some ways on its surface kind of sounds like a fluffy topic, but I truly believe that, you know, we're living in a very transformative time when it comes to food in America, and the sort of rise of food into mainstream American culture is, I think, has been quite stunning. And, you know, my interest in that really does stem from the fact that I think New Orleans has played a crucial role in that cultural development, you know, most obviously by Paul Prudhomme and Emeril Lagasse. And I'm interested in sort of making myself a little bit more expert, so to speak, on all of the sort of players in that. But then I'm also interested in studying sort of the mental health impact of disasters on communities, which is, you know, I guess goes without saying, is an interest that came from living and reporting about Hurricane Katrina and in some ways the BP oil spill. And then, you know, I'm also interested in like someone explaining Faulkner to me, you know, and learning, studying politics and things like this.
When you imagine Brett's perfect world after the Nieman, mm-hmm. What does it look like?
Well, it looks like New Orleans. And, you know, my perfect world, I get to live in New Orleans. The, you know, professionally, I do have an opportunity to return to, you know, the Times-Picayune in its new form. And I am hopeful that that will work out. You know, so much has changed in the last couple of months. And you know, my chosen field is really transforming rapidly, and in 10 months probably will continue to do so. And so it's sort of hard to know what the future is going to be and what sort of opportunities I'll have, but it's my hope to live in New Orleans and to be a working journalist and writer in New Orleans, writing about New Orleans.
Will you come back and talk to us again?
It will be my pleasure.
Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
Brett Anderson, once and maybe future restaurant critic of the Times-Picayune. It's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, who is the indisputable king of cocktails and founder of the Museum of the American Cocktail, is Dale DeGroff. Dale acquired that title when he began the craft cocktail movement at New York's famed Rainbow Room. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, we've been doing our culinary quiz for nearly a year, and I'm always delighted when we have a question about liquors or libations. That's because our contestants always seem to end their answers with gratuitous exclamation points. It's just another fine example of that irrepressible enthusiasm that's so distinctive to Louisiana. So congratulations to Gail Taylor of Miro for winning this week's prize, and we hope you'll send us your answer this coming week.
Our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the other name for Linda Green's famous second-line dish, the soupy hangover cure, Yakamen? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the other name for Linda Green's famous second-line dish, the soupy hangover cure, Yakamen? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at wwno.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Baton Rouge-based food writer and photographer Frank McMahon savors the cultural connections of Louisiana as he crosses our state with camera, notepad, and appetite. As Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Frank's sharing with us his latest and greatest food finds. Frank, what are you serving us today?
Well, Poppy, today we're going to talk about the real explosion of traditional Mexican and Latin American cuisine in Baton Rouge. You know, we for a long time had been a desert in that regard, and we'd had our fair share of Tex-Mex type places, but in the past couple of years, we've just seen some amazing spots open up. The last 6 months, in particular, La Moroneta has opened up on Florida Boulevard, which is a supermercado, for lack of a better term, with a astounding variety of chilies and wonderful tomatillos, hard to find items like cactus leaves, fresh espeyote. They've got a great meat counter that has a lot of items that you wouldn't traditionally find in the average Piggly Wiggly, let's put it that way.
So, Frank, are they actually producing any food there?
They are. They've got a little deli there that has a variety of hot and cold items. There's kind of a taco line, really, that has great chopped cilantro, or again, that crema, or those great little like sliced serrano peppers. And they've got a selection of different moles that they make there. So you can get a to-go lunch or dinner that is either like, you know, a more traditional tacos al pastor, or you could get tongue, and then obviously chicken and beef. And the hotline there is great. And I won't even pretend to tell you that I know everything that's there, because there were some things that I just sort of pointed and got and loved. You really can't beat it.
So what else is happening in a south of the border way there in Baton Rouge?
Well, oddly enough, also in Florida, there's another great little spot that I've been a fan of for several years named El Poste Dorado. And they've got a little bakery in there, and they also sell, you know, some of the dry goods, whether it's chilies and adobo sauce or that sort of thing. But in my opinion, what they're really great at is their traditional Mexican food. Again, you know, straying away from the Tex-Mex kind of stuff. And they've got chilaquiles that I'm a huge fan of and go there on Saturday mornings often to eat. The chilaquiles are a traditional Mexican hangover cure, and so you don't have to be hungover to eat them, but they're fine in any condition. But it's sort of a mound of soft corn tacos that's covered in fried eggs and salsa verde and cilantro and a little sort of dry crumbled cow's cheese. And it also generally comes with like a side of salsa that is pretty fiery hot for a salsa verde. And then obviously some refried beans on the side as well. But it's a great way to start a Saturday.
Well, Frank, you are making me some hungry. I want to thank you so much for giving us this on-the-spot reporting. Will you let us know what's going on again sometime soon?
Absolutely. There's all kinds of things happening all around Baton Rouge and right across the river in between here and Lafayette. So I'll be happy to keep you all up to speed on what's going on.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McMahon. I think the best souvenir you can bring home from a trip is a taste memory. Down a winding alley in Florence, in a cafe so tiny it seemed like a grandma's dining room, I tasted my first steak Florentine. The steak was cooked very rare and thinly sliced, topped with peppery, tender leaves of watercress, lightly dressed in buttery olive oil and lemon juice. I've recreated the dish at home many times since, reliving that magical moment in Italy, and I can say for sure the taste memory is more precious to me than anything I could have brought home in a suitcase. To learn how to prepare steak Florentine my way, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm going back to Tuscany and Umbria next April for another serving of authentic Italy. If you're tempted to come along, join in an online interactive presentation Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. The trip benefits PBS member station WYES, so visit wyes.org to learn more. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. With some of the experience New Orleans cooks as her competitors on a recent episode of the Food Network's Chopped, Yakaman lady Linda Green emerged the unlikely victor. Linda gives us a behind-the-scenes look at her Chopped experience when we return after this break. Poppy Tooker. And on this week's Louisiana Eats, we're going behind the scenes with Yakaman lady Linda Green on the Food Network's Chopped. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is a Southwest Louisiana third-generation rice farmer in Kinder. 15 years ago, our hero realized that years of conventional farming had killed the soil in his fields, and he set out to restore his family's land.
The whole trick is just getting a soil, a living soil, and everything starts there. I mean, that's the life, everything. Everything starts with the soil, and it starts with the bacteria in the soil. And I didn't realize it back then, but I had a dead soil. I had actually probably never seen a live soil before. It smells good. It's fluffy. When you move it, there's little insects and animals and earth and everything just running around all over the place. And every time you look in it, you'll see new insects you've never seen before. It always looks like it's just been plowed. When you move your cover crop, it's just loose and fluffy. The biggest thing is the oxygen's in the soil. It's getting the air, it's getting the carbon dioxide it needed. It's having the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide. And when the exchange is all balanced, everything just flourishes.
Aside from his organic and biodynamic growing methods, this week's hero encourages the growth of a wild red rice that other conventional farmers regard as a noxious weed.
It's just a native rice that just, it's crossed, it's grown on its own. It's very, very hard to manage. It is in a crop. What happens, it has a much shorter maturing date and it has a shattering problem. And when it grows, it falls off on the ground. It's very hard to manage. Things just worked out right. I mean, I guess it just the good Lord made things work like for some reason. I had to cut the water off. I did some insect control by removing the water. But when you did that, it allowed the red rice to come up. But the timing, it came up at the right time where I had it in the rice, and the customers have just loved it. I mean, I've just never got so much feedback in my whole life. In fact, I get customers wanting me to take the white rice out and send just the red rice to them. I can't do that.
With nutrition and flavor as his guide, rice farmer Kurt Unkle of Kinder, Louisiana, grows what he calls Cajun grain. Congratulations, Kurt. You're our Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero of the Week, recognized with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Do you know a culinary heritage hero? Send your nominations to louisianaeats@wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker. And Kurt Unkle's Cajun grain is Louisiana Eats. Miss Linda Green, also known as the Yakiman Lady, has long been a friend of ours here at Louisiana Eats. You may know Linda from the Jazz Fest, where she serves her signature Yakiman and an absolutely rockin' fried pork chop sandwich. With her recent win on the Food Network show Chopped, Linda's star is certainly ascending. Linda, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much, Poppy. Thank y'all for having me back.
So how did it happen that you came to compete on Chopped?
Well, I think you recommended me, and I'm more than sure Miss Judy Walker did too. And I filled out the application and the questionnaires that they gave me. It was a lot of fun filling it out. I was even laughing myself, and I just wanted somebody to catch what I was writing, and they did. They called me within the next week. I went to the interview at the hotel. And history was made because the first thing they said was, "We love you." That was the first thing they told me, "We love you." And I think they told me that because I told them, I said, "Y'all might have a human being in that basket, and I might have to stew him New Orleans style." And it just fell out. They said, "Oh my God, we love you." So when they told me that, I was just praying that they would pick me. And sure enough, they picked me. They was very patient with me. They were filling me into doing, you know, what to do, what to say and stuff like that. And I appreciate it.
Tell me how it went. You got on the plane and flew to New York. Had you been there before?
Never been to New York before in my life. I didn't even get a chance to enjoy it.
Oh, gosh.
So I was tired and wore out, but I was excited because I knew I won, but I couldn't say nothing.
Were you nervous?
I was. I was nervous. But believe it or not, the New Orleans chefs, the other ones who was with me, I enjoyed myself with them because I told them straight up, look, we're not doing what these other ones do. We don't do that. New Orleans is not like that. And they respected what I said, and it was like love at first sight.
So you were saying we got an even playing field and everybody's going to play nice, right?
Everybody going to play nice and everybody going to respect each other.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the food that they had you use, those ingredients.
Mm.
What did you find that you were using? Had you seen this stuff before?
Never seen a red or clam in my life. I think they were bleeping me, Poppy. They were bleeping me because I knew I was doing a lot of cussing. Like, what is this? But I may have missed one cleaning because one of them told me that one wasn't clean, but it was all right. I did cook it. I sauteed them, and I put what you call that Holy Trinity in it. That's what, and it made it look pretty. And I cooked them out the shell.
Uh-huh.
So what I did, I took the shells and I just kind of like decorated the plate. So I felt like I had to go on that one. But the plate looked pretty good.
That was a crazy dessert.
Yes. Oh, my God. Talking about the biscuit?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed with that one. They told me to make this beignet, and I did the first batch. It wasn't cooked inside.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go back, and I had to put more flour in it. And my mind went straight to the school board because I had to make biscuits. And that's what I said. They may not get that beignet, but they're going to get a biscuit out of me today.
So you worked for the school board, and you used to make at school.
Had to make biscuit from scratch. You had to do that.
How many hours did it all take?
I started at 6:15, and we ended up at 10:30 that night.
Wow. That was one hard day, huh? You earned that money, Linda Green.
Yes, I did. I did. You know, I look at and I hear everybody tell me that, and I appreciate it. I'm very humble about that. You want to hear something crazy?
Yeah, tell me.
I almost threw the check away.
How'd that happen?
I had been had the check for like 2 weeks and didn't know. Because by me getting the mail and just throwing it around, and believe it or not, something told me to look through my mail. And I seen something with network on it. I said, well, let me open this up. So I open it up, and I look and I see my name and $10,000. I just fell on the floor. I didn't sit on the floor. I fell on the floor. I said, oh, my God. I said, thank you so much. Because I actually almost threw it away.
Linda, the night the show aired, we were very honored to be included at your big party at the Rendezvous Tavern.
Oh, I was excited.
What did that night mean to you?
It mean a whole lot to me because I've never had a party before in my life. And I enjoyed it. And for people to come that I knew that loved me from their heart. And to see that my family was there too, my daughters, they were there. Y'all made my night, believe it or not. And I was excited when the part came where I won. It was like an uproar in that place.
It was.
Oh, my God. I mean, I felt so good.
Well, it was such a party. And your daughters are so proud of you.
Yeah.
It was so touching to talk with them. And they told me about how this food thing is really a big family tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your mama and how your mama influenced you.
Well, my mom was a cook. She was a cook for Orleans Parish School Board. She retired 30 years with them. And she was one of the best cooks because she used to do catering for the school board. Her mother and her grandmother showed her how to cook. And that comes from, you know, them showing each other what to do. So my mom showed me how to cook because I always stayed in the kitchen with her, always. You know, my mom showed me how to do that root. My mom used to take that chicken, you know, they used to have the chicken shack on the Conda.
Yeah.
And we'll get a live chicken, and they'll kill it, and she'll take the fat off that chicken and saute that grease. And my mom make the root out of that.
Oh, delicious.
That is delicious, believe it or not. And it's a golden, pretty brown. Oh, my God, it's so beautiful.
And she even taught you how to make the yak meat.
She taught me how to make the yak meat. She used to make yak meat at a bar, the bar that is in Treme. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, we did tell her she needed to venture out, but I'm glad she didn't because she had benefits with the school board and she retired. So, but she always did tell me that I'll be able to use it. And I am using it.
Linda, I know that our listeners would like to be able to find you.
Mm-hmm.
How can our listeners find Linda Green?
Well, right now, the only days that they can find me is on a Thursday until I get this truck together. And I do this at the Ogden Museum every Thursday between the hours of 6 and 8. And Poppy, they've been asking where I'm at. They've been calling. And believe it or not, they've been coming to the Ogden Museum.
So what's coming next for Miss Linda Green?
Well, I'm invited to San Francisco. I am presenting New Orleans' well-best-kept secret, yak meat, to them. They're going to fly me out there. They're going to put me in a hotel. They're going to give me 7 to 8 assistants, and they're buying all of the ingredients, and I am going to give them New Orleans' yak meat.
Well, thank you so much for telling us the behind-the-scenes tale.
And
thanks for coming to talk with us, and congratulations, Linda.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm humbled and I'm honored that I'm being loved by so many. And when I was on that show, all I kept thinking, I said, I just want New Orleans to be proud of me.
Well, New Orleans is proud of you.
Thank y'all so much. You. I appreciate it.
Yak Men Lady Linda Green, winner on Food Network's Chop.
You seen it never before. Have I felt so good just being my natural me? Will my hang up in my time? But deep inside, I'm free. Oh, let your hair down and get on.
For this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, Paul and Angela Knipple give us an international view of food in the South.
The South has really opened up with commerce. You find international markets in almost every major city. People are able to bring in things that they couldn't before. And then just like here in New Orleans, you see immigrants growing gardens, like the Vietnamese community has their huge gardens where they're growing their own produce. So we really don't see that many ingredient substitutions because people are able to get most of what they need.
And don't forget to tune in at our new times, Wednesday afternoons at 1 and Saturday morning at 11 on WWNO, and Saturdays at 1 on WRKF in Baton Rouge. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lightseagan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cooking Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to Thomas Walsh, our associate producer and sound engineer. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.